So we're beginning our study of Ezra chapter 4 now, Ezra chapter 4. And as we saw from the previous chapter, a very quick review. As we know, chapter 1 gives us the information about Cyrus, the king of Persia, there in the beginning of his reign as the emperor not only of Persia, but also having conquered Babylon. Now he is ruling over all of the territories of the Medes and Persians, and now all of the former Babylonian Empire. So this is why he's known as or referred to as Cyrus the Great, and known to history as such. Although, of course, it's God who gave him the position and authority that he had, and Cyrus acknowledged such in chapter 1, but the scriptures had also revealed that God had chosen him to be the one to restore the captives of Israel, restore them from, bring them back from Babylon to Israel, and to rebuild the temple. And so that work was commissioned by Cyrus, and he also provided the all of the means, the finances, everything for that work to be done, for the temple of the Lord to be rebuilt in Jerusalem by his people. And then chapter 2 described the return of the captives that were almost 50,000 exactly in number. So small in comparison to the number that once inhabited the land prior to the captivity, but this is what is left of that remnant. So all the others were gone, as we know from what happened 70 years before. Even before that, when you had the 10 tribes of the north, the northern kingdom, which is going to be relevant to what we start to look at here at the beginning of chapter 4. But they had been taken away by the Assyrians many years before, almost 200 years before Babylon came and conquered the southern kingdom of Judah. But so Judah was left with Benjamin, and then the majority of them were the rotten figs that God appointed for destruction, and Jerusalem fell, and the temple was destroyed, and so just a remnant was taken over to Babylon, and of all those ones, 70 years later, this number of about 50,000 went back to the land of Israel. For the purpose of restarting the nation in the land that God had chosen for them, and to rebuild the temple that was going, it was the where God had chosen for His authority to be for His people, and so these were people that were, for the vast majority of which or of whom were leaving the only place that they had known in captivity, so. There were some who made the journey that were of an age where they remembered being in the land before the captivity, and remembered the first temple before it was destroyed. But they would have been a minority of these ones who of the captives who returned. So most of them were people that went to go to a land that they were unfamiliar with, for the reason of serving the Lord. So these were the ones that the Lord had described in Jeremiah 24 as the good figs that he was going to bring to repentance, and now he has. And so we saw those repentant people led by Zerubbabel, who was the son of Shealtiel and grandson of Jehoiachin, who was the son of Jehoiakim, grandson of Josiah, that had been removed from the throne by Nebuchadnezzar and carried away to Babylon, where he lived for the rest of his life. Zerubbabel then was that king's grandson. So he was in the royal line, also, as we saw, in the ancestry of Christ. We read about his place in that in Matthew chapter 1 at the beginning of the New Testament, as it shows us how Jesus Christ was the rightful heir to the throne of David, and so that came through the royal line of David. David had many children, but there was one line that was the line of the kings, and that's the one that Jesus descended through from David, and that included this Zerubbabel here. And then Joshua the high priest, along with Zerubbabel, they were the leaders of the Israelites in bringing them back and doing this work of the Lord to rebuild the temple. And so in chapter 3, they laid the foundation of it. They first built the altar and started the sacrifices. So they did the parts that they could do to keep the Lord's commandments. That was their priority to begin with, to reinstitute all the things that they could of God's commandments to be able to start obeying them again. And so they got that in order. They observed the Feast of Tabernacles there in that seventh month when they returned, and then laid the foundation of the temple. And when they laid that foundation, the reaction of the ones who were there, of their number that remembered the first one, responded in what way? Everybody else is rejoicing that that foundation had been laid, but the ones who remembered the first one saw that in comparison, they could look at the foundation now and see this is nothing like the first one, nothing like Solomon's temple in its dimensions. And so they were discouraged by that and wept. And so there was weeping among the people from them. So you had that mixed reaction. When they laid the foundation, that was described there at the end of chapter 3. And also in the book of Haggai, as we saw, that Haggai and Zechariah, the prophets, were there with the people at this time. And so both of the books that bear those prophets' names describe this work that was going on here that we're reading about in Ezra. In fact, those two prophets are mentioned at the beginning of the next chapter, in chapter 5. So they were right there with the people to encourage them in the building of it. And we already saw some of the ways that the devil was trying to work against the people to get them to stop this work of the Lord. So what was the first thing that we saw? Well, it was to discourage them in looking at the work they were doing, to try to get them to look at that from an outward standpoint. Well, this work doesn't look very big. This work doesn't look very important. This looks small compared to that first temple. That was mentioned in Haggai chapter 2. And what was one of the ways that God used Haggai the prophet to get the people to overcome that discouragement? Not to look at it from the outside, from the physical dimensions of that foundation that looked like nothing compared to the first building, the first temple, but rather to recognize what God was planning to do with that work from a spiritual standpoint. And what did God say about the glory of this, what looked like a much inferior building physically or from a material standpoint? What did God tell the people that he was going to do with that temple compared to the first? He was going to bring it much more glory. And that was going to be ultimately fulfilled by whom? Who was he going to send? Who would be the one to one day be doing great miracles and teach and reveal the new covenant and do many wondrous works in that very building? And of course, that would be Christ, God's Son. I mean, how could they know that or foresee that coming down the line, which was still, 500 years into the future, a little more than? I mean, they couldn't see what the work they were doing at that moment, what five centuries later, how God was going to be using that and to His own for His glory. And it is a reminder for our work for the Lord. And one of the big lessons here is, we God gives us an opportunity to do something. How do we measure that opportunity and whatever that work is? Do we look at it and say, well, that's just, I don't really feel like doing that. That's nothing. No, everything, even giving a cup of water to one of his disciples in his name is a work that will be rewarded, and we should not judge that from the outside. And so that was encouragement that God gave through Haggai for them to not look at the work from that standpoint, but to be encouraged in it, because God was going to use this good work they were doing for his glory in a wonderful way. And through Zechariah the prophet, he told them not to despise the day of small things. So not to look at God's work and deem it small and then think nothing of it and be discouraged in doing it for looking at it from that wrong perspective. Well, then the next way that we saw that the devil was trying to discourage them, really at the same time as he was trying to get them to look at this, well, this is a nothing work. He also was getting them to get caught up in having their priorities out of order. As we saw in Haggai chapter 1, well, they're rebuilding the temple, but here they come back, they come to this land, and it's a land of rubble as far as any of the fenced cities in Judah and Jerusalem itself. So did any of them start to get caught up in taking care of their own situation, building their own houses, and thinking about their own works for what they needed for themselves, as opposed to what needed to be done for the Lord first and foremost? Well, that was one of the lessons from chapter 1. So the devil was already after them from the moment they start laying the foundation. You need to be thinking about yourselves and about what you need. And look at this work you're doing. This is some small nothing work. And so the devil's already starting in these ways. And so we do need to learn the methods and the wiles of the devil and how he operates and the ways in which he was trying to discourage them. He still is using those same methods today, so we can learn a lot from that to not be pulled away from doing God's work as we should and become focused on what our own desires are or in misjudging the work God gives us to do and looking at it from the outside and not be... looking at it from the standpoint of fulfilling the will of God for his glory and whatever he has, may have planned for the opportunities he gives us. Well, what comes next? This gets us into chapter 4. So is the devil going to, now that they've learned, okay, they're not going to let God's work languish by building, spending all their time building their own houses and planting their own vineyards and things. They're going to stay busy with God's work, and they're not going to despise the work they're doing. They're going to be encouraged to do it. God's going to bring great glory to this work, no matter what it looks like to their physical eyes. So they overcome that. They're pressing on to do the work. So does the devil just going to go away? Well, I failed here. I tried two methods to get them discouraged and stop. So that's over and done with. I've lost this battle. That's not the way the devil is. So he's going to come after them in another way. And what's one of the most proven tactics that he uses to try to discourage God's people from doing God's work? Persecution. And that's going to come here in chapter 4. But and who's he going to use to persecute them? Well, he's going to start out with the people on the outside, these neighbors of theirs that he introduces in verse 1 of chapter 4, Ezra chapter 4, verse 1, and he doesn't refer to them as their neighbors here. He says, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel. So these ones who lived around them, were they their friends? Now, were there ever any Gentiles around the children of Israel that did not fall into the category of their adversaries? Well, there were some, they were the exceptions, but even looking at the time of Christ, were there any of the Romans themselves? How about some of their very soldiers that were deployed there to keep order and to prevent any kind of rebellion against Roman rule? Were there any of the Roman soldiers or the leaders of those soldiers that were not only not adversaries but friends of the Jews and converts? Well, we all remember the Roman centurion whose servant Jesus healed and had a faith that was beyond what Christ had seen among any of his own people of Israel, when that Roman man who had built a synagogue for the Jews. And so the Jews had told him that this Roman man, this Roman soldier, not just a soldier, but a leader, a captain of 100, a leader of 100 of their soldiers, one of their leaders, was worthy for Christ to do that miracle to heal his servant because of his love for God's people. And he recognized, he had obviously learned who the Lord was and believed in him, and then sent his messengers out to Jesus, telling him he wasn't worthy for Christ to come under his own roof, but that he recognized Jesus had the authority of God, and like himself, when he had authority, all he had to do was say the word, and his authority would be carried out by those under him. And he knew that Jesus could speak the word with God's authority. He could just say for that servant to be healed, and he didn't have to physically be there in his house to make it happen. And that understanding of the authority of God that Jesus had, was that something that was recognized really among the children of Israel to that extent at that moment? That was something beyond what Christ had seen among his own people. Of course, then we have who's the first Gentile convert to Christ in Acts chapter 10? Cornelius, who was a Roman centurion. So there were times even when soldiers for nations who were that Israel was under their dominion that were not adversaries, but even were converts. So the fact that that these people around them were there did not automatically make them to be their adversaries, but that's the way it was, and that is also the pattern that we have. As far as those that are not believers in the Lord, there's some that will ask us a reason of the hope that is within us, as he says in 1 Peter 3:15, and we need to be ready always to give an answer to those ones. But who does the devil use to bring persecution upon God's people? He uses those of the world that are not believers in him. And of course, as we also know, he's gonna use those in our own families too that fall in that category. But here he's gonna start with these ones who dwell in the land. The Israelites come back from Babylon, and the land is not from Dan to Beersheba. It's not without inhabitants. Jerusalem was, and the land of Judah was laid desolate by the Babylonians. There was even a remnant that the Babylonians allowed to stay there, so that land wasn't going to be empty. Very small number, and Jeremiah was with them. We studied about them, but they didn't stay there in the land as the Babylonians had given them opportunity to do. What did they end up doing? They ended up going down to Egypt in disobedience to God's explicit commandment not to go down there. But when they told Jeremiah, tell us what God says, and whatever he says, we'll do it. And then he told them what God said, and they didn't do it. They did the opposite. Well, God didn't really say that when he told them, gave them an answer that they didn't like. Then they went on down to Egypt anyway, and there they perished. So there was an opportunity for some of the Israelites to remain in cultivate that land of Judah. Well, since they're not there, does nobody fill in any gaps? Who was there in the land that would be that would fill that space? Well, these and they're going to describe who they are, but we should know who they are from what we studied before. All right, if we had the map out and looked at Israel, which obviously is very much a north-south oriented country as far as its land and from the perspective, if you were looking, we had a map right here. The Mediterranean Sea would be over here, and then you have this very narrow strip of land, Israel, and the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, and then the Dead Sea down in the south. Well, Judah's land, their territory, and then Benjamin right on its northern border, that was in the southern part of the land. But all those, the other 10 tribes had their territory north of there. Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, those 10 tribes during those 200 years where the kingdoms were split, and there were two. Those 10 tribes of the northern kingdom of Israel that were under the kings, beginning with Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, all the way down through Hosea, those tribes ended up being taken away out of the land by the Assyrians. So we want to go back to the book of 2 Kings for a moment to read about that. This is a refresher. But in 2 Kings chapter 17, this tells us the background of the people that we're now reading about in Ezra chapter 4. So this is going to be 200 years. We're going back in time 200 years, really, to when the northern kingdom of Israel falls. We'll see the origins of these people that are in the land of Israel that are going to be the adversaries of Zerubbabel and Joshua and this remnant of the captivity who have returned to build the temple. The question, number one, the easy question to answer, are they happy that the Jews have returned to the land? Are they, finally, some people have come back, these people have come back, and now all these places that they vacated, they can rebuild it, and they can be here, and good, we're not going to be so lonely anymore. I mean, is that their perspective? Not at all. They are very displeased to see this people return. They were happy for them to be gone. And their preference would have been that they were gone in forever. That was not God's plan, and they are going to oppose their return and try to stop them from prospering, and they're going to try to stop them from rebuilding the temple of the Lord. So in 2 Kings chapter 17, we see who these people are and how they got there. In verse 22, 2 Kings 17, verse 22, it says, for the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They departed not from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants, the prophets. So was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. Now, if you want further details of that, the beginning of this chapter describes the siege of the city of Samaria. Already several of their those tribes in the north around Galilee have fallen to the Assyrians, and they were taken away. So they only had about half of those 10 tribes that were left at the point of the beginning of 2 Kings 17 that then fell to the Assyrians after the siege of Samaria, and then they were carried away to Assyria. Now, unlike what happened with the remnant of the children of Judah that were carried away into Babylon, these ones who were carried away by the Assyrians to their lands, they were not preserved there to return to the land. They're scattered among territories that the Assyrians had conquered, and they are not together as a distinct people anymore physically. Spiritually, they had already lost their distinctiveness as followers of God. For how, I mean, from the time that the kingdom split, as we just read there in verse 22, from the they walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They departed not from them. That was the first king that they had after the split, after Solomon's death. They'd been following a different religion, and they had gotten further and further away from God through all of that, and never repented. So was there anything about them spiritually that identified them as followers of Jehovah at the point where they fall here in 2 Kings 17? There's no spiritual distinction between them and these people of the world. They're idolaters. They don't follow God at all. So when they're removed physically from the land, I mean, do they hold together in as a group somewhere and as followers of Jehovah? No, they've lost all of that. And they become, now historically they're referred to often as the lost tribes of Israel, because they never came back. Well, because they were of the world. They got scattered in among people that they were just like. So that's the end of them, and they're never returned to the land. They come to an end as far as their existence as people of the Lord, because of all this wickedness that they hadn't departed from. And so it says in verse 23, or verse 24, it says, "And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cutha and from Ava and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof." The Assyrians bring in people to fill the space that God's people had once dwelt in. Now, if you went back to chapter, or earlier in this chapter, to verse 6, it names places where the Assyrians put the Israelites that they removed. It says they placed them in Halah and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. So they don't just put them in one location. They take them and scatter them in several places far from the land they just removed them from. And they don't take one nation from another place. It's not like they're swapping out nations. They take one group of people, put them over where somewhere, and then take another intact group and put them in the place where they just removed the first group or nation. That's not what they did. They took them out, scattered them all over, and then they took a scattered collection from different places and bring them in. So what's the effect of all of that? If you can see that, they conquer these different nations and they keep doing that, instead of having intact, distinct nations that exist anywhere, everybody's all mixed up. They've scattered everybody all over the place, and they're really no distinct nations. Now, from a political or strategic point of view, what would be behind that? What would be behind that strategy? Conquer a bunch of lands, and then you have people that are not together as distinct nations anymore. Then, if you keep them, if they stay in their place as a nation, then might they at some point rebel? But if everybody's all mixed up and scattered everywhere, how do you get all your people back together and organize a rebellion so that you can go back to your old homeland? I mean, that would make that very, very difficult, wouldn't it? So, I mean, it's not difficult to see the logic they would have in doing what they did as they did it. But that's what happened. So they bring in, so the ones that come into Israel, they're not all one from one place. They're from a collection of places. So it's a mixture of people brought in, and then the Assyrians fill this space with the ones from that has been created by removing the Israelites that they've then scattered in a bunch of places of their that they had conquered. So that's what happened. So all these ones from those nations he named, he placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and the cities and dwelt in the cities thereof. And verse 25 here in 2 Kings 17 says, "And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, The nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he hath sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land." Well, is there any truth to that statement that they were making? Well, I mean, who did send the lions? Well, yes, that would be from God. And were these people followers of God? No. Now, God just removed a bunch of idolaters that used to be his people from the land. And now here people come in, and what are they doing? Well, they're idolaters also. And you can see from their own words, the God of the land. So they're... The understanding of so many of these nations there, they had their own national gods. They worshipped other idols with it, but they would usually identify particularly with one. And so they looked at each of these lands as having their god that would be one among many. So now they're thinking, okay, we don't know the god of this land, and so that's why we're having this problem. But of course, it's not the God of this land, or the God of that land that they didn't know is the only God of all lands of the universe. They don't understand that, but we got to find out what are the customs of this particular God here, so that we don't have these lions among us. So that's what their thinking. And so they speak to the king of Assyria about this. What does the king of Assyria do? Okay, verse 27, "Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, Carry thither one of the priests whom you brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. On the surface, that might sound, okay, well, this will help them to come to learn about the true God of heaven. Except... What priest is he going to send there to be their teacher? One of the priests from the people that have just been taken out of the land. Well, what kind of priest did they have, and what kinds of things had they been doing? This was what goes to the heart of why they've been removed from the land in the first place. Well, what had Jeroboam done all the way back in 1 Kings chapter 12? What had Jeroboam the son of Nebat, what did he do when he became the first king of this, these 10 tribes of the north after Solomon's death, when the kingdom was split? Well, he didn't want the people going to Jerusalem, where the temple was, and go there three times a year. And that was the capital of the rival kingdom that Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, now ruled over. In his foolish mind, he thought if they're going there, they're going to end up identifying with the king of Judah, and I'll end up losing my kingdom and my life. He didn't believe God's promise to him that if he served the Lord, that his kingdom would be sure. So he made up a new religion to forbid them from going to Jerusalem. You don't need to go there anymore. He made 2 golden calves and put one in Dan and one in Bethel at either end of the kingdom, and said, "These be your gods that brought you up out of Egypt." So they worshiped those golden calves, and then he created different feast days for them to observe there in those places, where he set up altars none of which was authorized by God. In fact, contradicted what God had commanded or forbidden. He made them to make other gods before them and to make graven images, those golden calves. I mean, so he's already breaking the first two of the Ten Commandments by founding this new religion. So he makes up an entire religion for his kingdom to follow. But part of that is also, well, any true priests of the Lord, are they going to be attending at an altar in Bethel where a golden calf has been made? Of course not. No godly priest of the Lord is going to be involved in that. So he's got to have a priesthood to go with this religion. Well, what does he do? It tells us in 1 Kings 12 what he did. He makes up his own priest. By God's law, only the descendants of Aaron of the tribe of Levi could be priests of the Lord. That's not what Jeroboam did. So 1 Kings 12:31 says, and he made the house a house of high places and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. So he created his own priests. The Lord sent a prophet to rebuke him for all of this in the next chapter, but he didn't repent. 1 Kings 13:33 says, after this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way, but made again of the lowest of the people priests of the high places. Whosoever would, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places. So what kind of qualifications did they have? Now, what did we see in Ezra chapter 2 when you had some of these ones that came from Babylon that people would have known with 70 years? I mean, people that knew these people, would they know who their parents or who their grandparents were? I mean, yeah, I mean, a lot of us know things about each other's families, but especially if we were all one physically related group. But, I mean, they would know that. But what ended up happening if they didn't have the preserved genealogical records where it showed who they were generation by generation, where it was proven by the record that they were descendants of Aaron? They could not be priests. We saw that at the end of Ezra chapter 2, that those ones who didn't have the proof from the records couldn't serve as priests. So it wasn't, I mean, they couldn't make the argument, well, you know who I am. You remember my grandpa so-and-so? Remember, he was a priest. That wasn't sufficient. They couldn't go by, we all know who you are. No, it had to be able to be proven by the records in order to comply with it. There was no way that they were going to be able to do something where there could even possibly be a mistake on that, because then it would be outside of what God had authorized, and they would have somebody who potentially who was not qualified to be a priest. So if it was that strict, then what about just choosing anybody like Jeroboam did? Was that a minor thing, or was that a major problem, major sin against the Lord? Well, that's who the priests were. That's what Jeroboam started, and that carried through all the way, as we just read. Did they ever depart from those sins? They did not. So when the king of Assyria says, okay, we better send one of these priests of these people that we removed from the land to teach the new inhabitants the manner of the God of the land, what kind of a person is that going to be? And what kind of knowledge and understanding of God and his will are they going to have? Yes, only a tiny. They'll just be familiar with the name, a very faint or scant familiarity with the true God of heaven and any of his commandments. They were not following them, or they wouldn't have been priests in the first place. So we can see that the result of this is not going to be something that's good. So the king of Assyria commanded to carry one of the priests there to teach them the manner of the God of the land. So in Second Kings 17, verse 28, it says, then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel. That's where they had one of the golden calves. That's where the main altar was, where Jeroboam would go. That's where these false priests served. So he goes to this place, which was one of the main centers, really the center, main center of the false religion that they had established there. And it says, and he taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made. And there we read the name. The Samaritans. So that's what they become known as. That's the name of this group of not just one nation, but from several nations. They're all together here now in the land, but now collectively, they are by the area that they've been put in. These are the Samaritans. So these are their descendants are the ones that we read about in the New Testament in the time when, like the parable of the Good Samaritan. From the time they come into the land, what's going to be their relationship with those who are following God, the children of Israel? I mean, from the outset here, they're bringing in these outsiders to fill the land that God had given to his people. So there's going to be no basis of friendship or an alliance here, is there? This is enmity is going to be the situation from the beginning. It says they brought in their gods, which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. So how many different idols are going to be represented by these different people? I mean, we're not given the number, but you know, there's a lot. And the men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, and the men of Cuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz, and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burnt their children in fire to Adrammelech, and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. So they feared the Lord and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high places, which sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. Well, who instructed them to do that? Well, this priest, that's the custom they had followed in the land, which got them removed. So what do they end up doing? They just add Jehovah to this list of so-called gods that they're following. They're just going to make sure you include him. So they're just adding him as if he's one among a bunch of idols. So when it says they feared or served Jehovah, not the way God had commanded, of course, but they're just adding that. Make sure you do some worship of Jehovah too. Don't leave him out. Make sure you've got some priests, even though it's not following what God commanded. So there's no way they're going to be following the truth here. So verse 33 says, they feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. Unto this day they do after the former manner. They fear not the Lord. Well, didn't it just say they fear the Lord? Well, this is talking about now in truth. So they feared the Lord as in they were giving him some allegiance or worship along with these idols. But when it comes down to what the true fear of the Lord is, did they have that? No. So they didn't have the fear of the Lord. He says, neither do they after their statutes or after their ordinances or after the law and commandment which the Lord commanded the children of Judah, whom he named Israel. So they didn't follow him in truth, and that's the only way to follow him. Brother Michael?
It seems like the men of Athens follow this pattern. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, they even had that altar to the unknown God just to make sure that they had, if there was one they were leaving out that they didn't know about, they were trying to cover that base. That was the one they didn't know who was the God of heaven. So that's where Paul, yes, very good. That's exactly what was going on then. So here's what they were doing, but they were not keeping God's commandments. And it says, verse 35, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, you shall not fear other gods, nor bow yourselves to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them. They were doing that. Verse 36, but the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt with great power and stretched out arm, him shall you fear, and him shall you worship, and to him shall you do sacrifice. And the statutes and the ordinances and the law and the commandments which he wrote for you, you shall observe to do forevermore, and you shall not fear other gods. And the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, neither shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God shall be your fear, and he shall deliver you out of the hand of all your enemies. Howbeit they did not hearken, but they did after their former manner. So these nations feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their children's children, as did their fathers. So do they unto this day. Well, would that include the day that we're reading about here at the beginning of Ezra chapter 4? Yes. So they come to Zerubbabel, and they're their adversaries. They're not happy at all about these people coming back. This would have been more land for them to inhabit in Israel. And so these people coming back and repopulating these cities, they're not pleased with that at all. But they don't come first with the persecution. They come with the flattery and try to get the people of Israel to join, to let them join in with the work. So verse 2, Ezra 4 verse 2 says, "Then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Azarhaddon, king of Asser, which brought us up hither." And that's in reference to what we just read about in 2 Kings 17 from 200 years before when they first got there. By testimony of their own mouth, are they practicing any different religiously than what we read about in 2 Kings 17 at this point, 200 years later? No, they're still doing that. But they're making reference to the fact that they had added Jehovah worship to everything else they were doing. We added him in among our pantheon of so-called gods that we've been following 200 years ago, and we're still at it. So we worship the same God you do. Well, saying that, I mean, how many people today believe in Jesus? And just using that term at its absolute loosest, will claim that they believe in Jesus. Think about the number. The number of those today in this world who claim to be believers in Jesus Christ as God's Son versus the number of people who are actually keeping the commandments of Jesus Christ, God's Son. Is that number the one and the same? Or is the number of claimants far, far greater than the numbers of ones who actually are observing and following what he has said? Are those numbers even close? They're not. So when we look at it from that standpoint, we should see the relevance to whatever he's going to be teaching us about here, because it's exactly what's going on in the world today. Lots of people claim to believe in God or claim to believe in Jesus, but how many really believe in him from as the Lord defines it and demonstrate it by following his commandments? That's what he was showing in 2 Kings 17. They weren't doing that. These Samaritans weren't doing that. They didn't really fear the Lord because they weren't keeping his commandments. They were violating his commandments. But they're claiming to be just like the Jews here that have come back. So they're saying, we believe the same God that you're following, so hey, we're going to let us join in. We'll help you. We'll help you rebuild this temple to this God that we also worship like you do. That's their offer. Now, Zerubbabel is going to recognize the fallacy or the foolishness of this. And so in verse 3, Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, "You have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us." Then verse 4 shows when they won't let them join in with him, then they trouble them in their building. Okay, so what was this a sincere offer of help, number one? What would have happened if they had let them, okay, sure, you believe in the Lord like we do, come on in and help us out here. What would they have been doing? Would that have made the work go faster? More hands involved in the work? They get the temple built quicker? Is that what would have happened? No. These people had no desire to help them. Would they have used that opportunity to find a way to corrupt and destroy the work? Of course. But How would God have responded to them joining together with these people who were not following him in truth, to just based on their claim that they believe like they do, and if they join together with them based on their claims when they're not really following the Lord? Another way of asking today, do we just join together with anybody who claims to believe in Jesus, no matter what they're doing or what they're really believing in and practicing? And just as long as somebody claims to believe in Jesus, that's all it takes, and then we'll just go along with that, and whatever that brings. Is that a wise or proper way to approach things? It's not. We're out of time here. So Lord willing, we'll continue on, press that point further, dig into that a little more deeply next time, next Sunday, Lord willing. The lack of sincerity in that offer and the reason why they shouldn't and didn't have them involved with them is revealed when they don't let them join in. That's when they openly start persecuting them. So the first way the devil tries to use their enemies to subvert the work is by getting them to join together with them to believe their false claims and get them involved in the work of the Lord when they aren't really serving the Lord. And when they overcome that temptation, then they get the persecution. These are the wiles of the devil. He's doing every one of these things today. So Lord willing, we'll learn some more in our study as we continue it next time.